There is more ahead from Morning Edition on KAXE.
Good morning. Hamas returns its last living hostages to Israel. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert predicts what's next for his country after one of the biggest protest movements in its history. That's coming up on Morning Edition from NPR News. Government shutdown isn't delaying President Trump's efforts to log more trees on federal land. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. In Western Oregon, lumber mills say the biggest issue is that prices for their products are too low. Also, scientists say the fight against antibiotic resistance is one we're trying to lose as slowly as possible. New research says we are losing more quickly than before. It is Monday, October 13th. On this day in 2019, Simone Biles became the most decorated gymnast in history when she won her 25th medal at World Championships in Germany. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. In the Middle East, for the first time in 2 years, Hamas no longer holds living Israeli hostages. All 20 remaining captives have been turned over to Israel. The release coming as President Trump arrived in Israel for the next stage in a U.S.-brokered ceasefire deal. As the Knesset gathered in Jerusalem, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had effusive praise for the Trump proposals.
A proposal that opens the door to an historic expansion of peace in our region and beyond our region. Mr. President, you are committed to this peace. I am committed to this peace. And together, Mr. President, we will achieve this peace.
Netanyahu's office citing Jewish holidays has knocked down Egyptian reports that he'll participate in today's peace talks in Egypt. The ceasefire in Gaza is now in its fourth day. Israel is set to release nearly 2,000 detainees and prisoners, and significantly more aid is poised to flow into Gaza. NPR's Aya Batrawi has the latest.
The UN humanitarian agency OCHA says real progress is underway with cooking gas entering Gaza for the first time in months. People in Gaza have been burning plastic, clothes, wood, tires, and other items to bake bread and boil lentils and pasta. The UN says it was also able to bring in more tents for displaced families, frozen meat, fresh fruit, flour, and medicines on Sunday. It says aid groups distributed thousands of hot meals and bread bundles. Israel is easing restrictions on aid into Gaza as part of the ceasefire deal. Aid groups had called Israel's restrictions collective punishment as cases of severe malnutrition and deaths from hunger spiked in recent months. Aya Batrawi, NPR News, Dubai.
Thousands of federal workers received layoff notices Friday as the government shutdown continues today into day 13. NPR's Stephen Fowler reports.
About 4,000 people from at least seven agencies received these reduction in force notices Friday. That includes places like the IRS, the Education Department, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. A quarter of those layoffs were with the Department of Health and Human Services, with hundreds of firings slated for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But on Saturday, some CDC employees started learning their layoff notices were reversed. That includes some of the so-called disease detectives who work on investigating outbreaks. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
The Nobel Prize in Economics has been awarded to Joel Mocher, Philip Aguillon, and Peter Howitt. The awards committee noted each of the scholars had conducted research demonstrating how technology can drive sustained growth. Mocher has been a professor of economics and history at Northwestern University. Peter Howitt is at Brown University. Philip Aguillon is an economics professor at Collège de France and at the London School of Economics. This is NPR News in Washington. In Alaska, the remnants of Typhoon Halong tore through remote parts of the state with hurricane-force winds and devastating flooding. Rescue aircraft were dispatched to small Alaskan villages in the western part of the state, where as many as 20 people were potentially unaccounted for. The state's Emergency Management Office says there have been reports that some homes floated away, possibly with people inside. This Halloween might be the year of chewy and milky fruity treats instead of chocolate, as more shoppers are spooked by higher prices. This amid a global cocoa shortage. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
Federal data shows that the price of candy and chewing gum has grown more than 8% over the past year. That's largely because of cocoa prices at historic highs, thanks to several harvest shortfalls in West Africa, where most of the world's cocoa grows. This has brands getting creative to cut costs. KitKat, for example, has launched a green Halloween bar with matcha and another with cinnamon, no chocolate. And shoppers are increasingly reaching for chewy, gummy, and sour options. Retail research firm Circana finds that Americans are still spending more dollars on chocolate Halloween candy, but by volume, in pounds, they're buying more non-chocolate Halloween candy for the first time in several years. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
The Arthur M. Blank Family Foundation today announced a 10-year commitment worth $50 million to Atlanta's historically black colleges and universities. The goal is to raise graduation rates at Morehouse, Morris Brown and Spelman Colleges, and Clark Atlanta University. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
KEXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And, oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. In a few minutes, we'll speak with former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert about his view on President Trump's 20-point peace deal. But first this morning, all 20 surviving Israeli hostages are free.
Tens of thousands of Israelis celebrated the moment in downtown Tel Aviv as Hamas released the last surviving hostages they captured 2 years ago in the October 7th attack. In exchange, Israel is releasing nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. And President Trump has declared the Gaza war is over.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Tel Aviv. Daniel, what's it feel like there?
Hey, it's just unbelievable. I am at what's known as Hostages Square. I stood in a sea of people, tens of thousands of people, watching footage of the hostage release on a large screen. I watched men cry. I watched women cry. I watched them smile and cheer and then cry some more. This is Neva Perry.
We've waited for this moment so long. I'm full of hope after 2 years of devastation, of killing, of anxiety, remorse. I just can't contain my happiness. We have been protesting here for 2 long years. That's why I'm so overwhelmed. And I can't believe that we are here now.
You know, this is the culmination of one of the biggest, longest protest movements in Israeli history. People calling for Israel to strike a deal with Hamas, to release the hostages, and to end the war. And we have reached that moment, and it's a surreal one.
Yeah, definitely sounds that way. Tell us how the hostage release unfolded this morning.
Hamas transferred hostages to Red Cross vehicles inside Gaza. This happened in two separate groups around 8 a.m. local time and then 10 a.m. local time. They were taken across the border to an Israeli military base. Unlike earlier this year with the last hostage release, there were no Hamas ceremonies with hostages paraded on a stage. That was part of the ceasefire deal. And then Hamas today should be transferring the bodies of dead hostages, around 28 of them. But that will take longer because about a third of them are unknown where they are, or they're under rubble.
Yeah. Now, the living hostages, the ones released, what condition are they in?
Yeah, they're men and mostly in their 20s and 30s, including two pairs of brothers. Around half of the hostages released today were taken hostage at a music festival on October 7th, 2 years ago. And, you know, this morning, a few of the families got surprise video calls from Gaza where you see masked Palestinian militants standing next to the hostages and their families speaking to them for the first time, and the hostages are smiling. They're standing on their feet. They're being helicoptered to hospitals any moment now in Israel. And, you know, they've been more than 700 days in captivity. And what we know from previously released hostages and from videos Hamas published is that they likely have been kept in underground tunnels, held alone, starved. And so we don't know yet what their real condition is in both body and mind.
Okay, so what happens today?
Well, President Trump is in Israel. He's addressing the parliament. He's then going to Egypt for a summit with more than 20 world leaders to mark this moment. And almost 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees are being released from Israeli prisons. And hostages are spending their first day of freedom with their families. They've been waiting for this moment to heal for so long.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
Two of the hostages who were released this morning, Evyatal David and Guy Dalal, they were kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival on October 7, 2023, and held in Gaza for more than 2 years. Here's Guy's father, Ilan Dalal, speaking to reporters yesterday.
Our nightmare is finally coming to an end now.
Ilan said that Evyatar and Guy were best friends.
They grew up together. They went to this music festival together. They were kidnapped together. They suffered together in the tunnels, and now they're going back to their families.
Tal Shoham was in captivity with them until he was released in January. Speaking at the same press conference, he said recovery will be a long process and it will be different for all the former hostages.
We are not responsible to all the awful and cruelty things that happening to us. Our only mission is to become better every day and to clean ourselves from the cruelty and hell that we went through.
As we've been for more on this important day, we are joined by Ehud Olmert. He served as Prime Minister of Israel between 2006 and 2009. Prime Minister, thank you so much for joining us once again.
I'm delighted.
So as we've been hearing, there is joy over the release of the hostages. Israel is emerging from this war that's dragged on for more than 2 years. How would you summarize this moment?
Precisely as you did. This is a very unique moment in the life of a nation. We are full of joy and relief and a sense of fulfillment. We have finally brought back our people from the tunnels in Gaza. After 2 years of being there, all of them are back. Alive, and there are still some that ought to be brought back for burial. Unfortunately, the dead who were killed and murdered under the captivity of Hamas. But of course, the fact that we could bring all of them back with the extraordinary assistance in support of President Trump is a very unique moment in our lives. So at this moment, we are not making any calculations or discussions or drawing any kind of conclusions about what led to what and why did it have to take 2 years. Right now, there is one thing to do, and this is to be happy.
So what is your assessment of this 20-point peace plan that is on the table? Do you think this framework could lead to lasting peace?
No, look, this is not a peace agreement. It has never been called a peace agreement. It was called an agreement to comprehensive end of the war in Gaza. Full stop. Which is what it is, comprehensive end of the war in Gaza, return the hostages, releasing the prisoners, Palestinian prisoners, building a security force that hopefully will take over the military control in Gaza, and building up body of bureaucrats and technocrats that will replace the non-existent government, particularly after the demise of Hamas. Mm-hmm. But this is just the first step. It needs to be moved forward. And therefore, there ought to be a more broader concept of how we have to build the relations with the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. There has to be end-game solution. And in my mind, there can be only one, a two-state solution. Israel, and of course, alongside Israel, an independent Palestinian state. There will have to be established as a result of direct negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. I hope that President Trump, carried away by the emotions and the extraordinary support provided to him, will decide to take this one step further towards the beginning of negotiations between us and the Palestinians for a two-state solution.
Obviously, that's a longer conversation, but as Mr. Netanyahu, current prime minister, has stated that he objects to this, does not agree with this, will not agree to this. Do you think he can be moved?
You know, I'm familiar with what Netanyahu says and what he has been saying for years. I imagine that when President Trump told him, when they were sitting in the Oval Office in the White House just a week ago, that he has to call the Prime Minister of Qatar and apologize to him for the attack in Qatar, and that he has to read a text that was dictated by Qatar, and that the assistant of the Prime Minister of Qatar will be sitting next to him and will check that he doesn't miss one word of what was dictated to him, that Netanyahu wasn't very happy about it. But he did it because Trump had the power to force him to do it. So the question is not what Netanyahu wants. We all know what he wants, and we also know what he doesn't want. He doesn't want to move forward, broadly speaking, towards a solution that requires the recognition of a Palestinian state and the withdrawal of Israel from more than 90% of the territories that are now occupied by the state of Israel. That includes Gaza and the West Bank. I have proposed a full plan for such a peace in 2008 when I was prime minister. Mm-hmm. That included the creation of a Palestinian state on the basis of the 67 borders with the Arab side of Jerusalem as the capital of the Palestinian state, with the old city of Jerusalem, which is now under the exclusive political sovereignty of Israel, to lose this exclusive political sovereignty and be administered by a trust of five nations, including Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Palestine, Israel, and America, so that the most sensitive place in the universe, perhaps, okay, will not be subject to any exclusive political and military control that might have disrupt any possible agreement in the future. So all this was proposed. Unfortunately, at that time, the Palestinians didn't have the courage and the leadership to accept it. But this is something that now has to be pursued.
Okay.
And I believe that President Trump can force...
Okay. We have to leave there for now. That's Ehud Olmert, former Prime Minister of Israel. And this is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News. Support for KAXC comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. And we thank the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information at mndeerhunters.com. Weather today, mostly sunny, slight chance for showers early, especially on the eastern Iron Range. Highs in the mid-50s with breezy west winds. Partly cloudy tonight, lows in the low 30s, and for tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the low 50s. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. And we thank the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912, fsbbigfork.com, member FDIC. Coming up at 9 o'clock this morning, special programming for Indigenous Peoples Day. We'll be featuring the Three Non-Blondes, a.k.a. the Humphrey family, at 10 o'clock.
PR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice. At ajws.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The World Health Organization says a pillar of modern medicine is weakening. Antibiotics cure deadly infections and make medical care, like surgery, safer. But bacteria are evolving resistance to antibiotics faster than previously thought. NPR's Jonathan Lambert explains.
Antibiotics are really good at killing bacteria, but they're not perfect. In part, that's because bacteria vary in their vulnerability to antibiotics. Out of the billions of bacteria causing an infection, some just so happen to be naturally resistant. Here's Kevin Okuda, an infectious disease physician at UCLA.
Antimicrobial resistance is just basic evolution.
When doctors treat an infection with antibiotics, it wipes out the susceptible bugs. That clears the field for any resistant bacteria to spread. Overusing antibiotics when they're not needed can breed resistance too.
We are kind of in this battle that we're trying to lose as slowly as possible.
A new WHO report suggests humans are losing ground. In 2023, roughly 1 in 6 infections tested in labs around the world were resistant to antibiotic treatments. Nearly half of all tested pathogens saw increased resistance since 2018. Here's Raman Lakshminarayan, president at the One Health Trust, a nonprofit.
Frankly, it's quite concerning. I mean, we do see increases in resistance every year, but here we see a pretty sharp increase.
Some regions are seeing more resistance than others. The report found that resistance was generally worse in lower-income countries and those with weaker health systems.
For some of the most common infections that afflict tropical countries, nearly 50 to 60% of the infections are now drug-resistant.
These higher numbers could reflect countries only testing cases likely to be resistant, but they could also reflect genuinely higher resistance, stoked by poor health systems that can't get antibiotics to those who need them. More sophisticated antibiotics that could treat resistant infections are often out of reach.
So you see simultaneously the antibiotics are no longer working, but the antibiotics that do work are not available, and that is extremely worrying.
Over 1 million people already die each year from resistant infections. Without new antibiotics and better access to existing ones, that toll could grow.
We're sleepwalking into a disaster. I shouldn't say we are. I mean, we already have sleepwalked into a disaster.
Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Hey, A.
Yes.
Did you get a workout in this weekend? How'd it go?
I got two. One was an easy one, and the second one was I put myself through the ringer.
Excruciating. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Well, in the world of professional sports and fitness, people talk about training zones, a sort of spectrum of intensity from light exercise to really huffing and puffing. Sounds like that was you. For more casual athletes, one zone in particular is getting a lot of attention. Zone 2. NPR's Will Stone has this report.
Ask Carl Foster about the merits of Zone 2 training, and first, you'll get a question.
What Zone 2 are you talking about?
The answer can depend on the sport, the country, or even the kind of researcher you are. For instance, Foster is an exercise physiologist.
And we tend to think in terms of only three zones. And Zone 2 is sort of the middle zone, and it's athletic.
Tough. You're not entirely at your max, though. And Foster says there are thresholds you can clearly measure with blood tests and breathing patterns. But if you run into Zone 2 chatter these days, chances are this is not the intensity people are talking about. Instead, they're describing something more chill you can do for longer periods of time.
And Zone 2 is you can do a lot of training and you can get a lot of benefit with very minimal pain. And so that's attractive.
Here, Zone 2 sits on the lower end of a 5 or 6 zone scale, maybe even more. Steven Seiler is an exercise researcher at the University of Agder in Norway. He says professional cycling has fueled the current Zone 2 phenomenon. Because athletes are doing long training rides, they need to fine-tune their low-intensity work. But translating all this to the general public and different endurance sports can get tricky.
There's not a magic zone. That's what the research tells us.
Unlike elite athletes, the average runner doesn't necessarily have this wide range of lower intensity effort.
It can be very narrow. I know that by experience, coming back into running and feeling like, oh my goodness, I can barely run before I'm starting to feel like this is no fun.
Seiler has popularized polarized training. The idea here is that most of your endurance training should be in this easier, more sustainable realm, and then a smaller percentage at higher intensity. This is based on research of top athletes, but Seiler says the principle is helpful for all of us because...
The most common mistake is everybody ends up, their workouts all kind of regress towards the middle. And there's nothing wrong with that kind of workout, but if you do it every day, if you do it every time you train, then you stagnate pretty quickly.
So to avoid slipping into that pattern, he says there are some simple hacks for finding this Zone 2 space. You can basically have a conversation, your heart rate levels out after 10 to 15 minutes, and you can eat pretty quickly after the workout.
Then yeah, other days you're going to train harder, but you're putting together, you're composing an orchestra of training that's not all one note.
Now, some of the recent enthusiasm around Zone 2 is based on claims that it has special metabolic benefits, including for burning fat, that make it better. Brendan Gerd at Queen's University in Canada says the data don't really support that.
If you just want to get a little bit fitter and be active and be healthier, Zone 2 is great. But if you want to sort of maximize your 4 hours a week, the best 4 hours is probably going to be high intensity.
Billy Spurlich at the University of Würzburg in Germany agrees. If you're just looking at return on investment for cardiovascular benefits, burning energy, high intensity wins out. But you can't do that all the time. And he also sees the current interest in the Zone 2 concept as part of a broader back and forth in the fitness world.
We had a very, very strong, I would say, hype on high intensity exercise. And all of a sudden, whoop, everything went back to low intensity exercise. The answer is, for endurance athletes, it's a mix, basically.
And while there are different schools of thought about the exact mix, proponents of Zone 2 point to another upside. When a workout isn't too brutal, you're more likely to do it again. Will Stone, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
This is NPR News.
Welcome to Minnesota Native News. I'm Murray Rock. This week on Minnesota Native News, how tribal colleges and universities are responding to federal funding cuts, and a Red Lake artist shares details about a new film project. First, let's hear from producer Zan Holston.
For months, tribal colleges and universities, or TCUs, have been living under the threat of being defunded. Earlier this year, the Trump administration proposed a budget that cut their funding by 90%, a move that would effectively shut them down.
It's very hard to plan what an academic year is going to look like when you are concerned about inconsistency in funding.
Anna Wake Rose is president of AHEC, the American Indian Higher Education Consortium. She said since 80% of TCU budgets come from federal grants, it makes the schools especially vulnerable. But Congress failed to pass the budget by the end of September, triggering a government shutdown on October 1st. Just before the shutdown, the Department of Education awarded TCUs a one-time influx of $109 million, more than double the federal funding they got for the 2025 budget. That's enough money to keep schools open for at least another year.
We really can't even express how welcome it is and what an immediate impact and change it will bring on the education that we're able to provide.
That relief is crucial, but doesn't erase the bigger questions about the shutdown or whether the administration's proposed cuts will pass. If the cuts do go through, it would be devastating. Since TCUs don't typically have large reserves of money or endowments to draw from,
this academic year would be about how do you wind things down and shut things down as best as you can.
Still, Rose is confident that advocates in Congress are working to ensure TCUs remain funded.
We've also seen Congress propose some very strong numbers. We know that we have strong bipartisan support in Congress.
She also points to how investing in TCUs actually helps the U.S. economy. AHEC recently released a report showing alumni contributed $3.8 billion to the country's gross domestic product between 2022 and 2023.
When you look at the overall economic impact that we've had within our communities, we've been able to do that with drastic underfunding. So imagine what we could do if our institutions were fully funded.
For now, the future of TCUs rests with Congress. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Zan Holston.
Next, a new film project weaves together an artist's tragic story with Ojibwe mythology. Travis Zimmerman has more.
Original artist and storyteller Jonathan Thunder has been busy writing and directing a short film, Ish Meets a Mermaid. Ish is short for Ishkade, which means fire in Ojibwe, and the film has been a labor of love for the talented Red Lake artist. Jonathan stars in the film alongside his wife, brother, and other family members.
I play Ish, the struggling artist. And my wife, Tashia, she plays Zebe, who is the mermaid. I got my brother, Charles, to play this character named Crazy Al, who I don't know what to say about Crazy Al, but everybody knows a Crazy Al, you know, in their lifetime. And Crazy Al had to go into the script.
When asked what else makes the film unique, Jonathan gives us a glimpse of the storyline.
It's a story that combines the tragic artist's biography that I've always been in love with, and it combines it with Ojibwe mythology based in the Great Lakes region.
Ish Meets a Mermaid was shot in Duluth and involves several of Jonathan's friends.
Alex Komet plays a character called the Busker, which is, he's kind of like a portal to the Twilight Zone in Ish's life. And my friend Hannah Smith also kind of plays a role between worlds as a train ticket clerk.
Now that production is officially over, the film is in the editing phase.
I'm kind of from the experimental film school. I'm doing the edit as well, and I've done some of the visual effects that go into the film.
People can expect to see the film making the film festival rounds in 2026.
I'm hoping to have it done with post-production by the end of the year.
People can still support the film and follow Jonathan to see what else he is up to.
IshMeetsAMermaid.com or JonThunder.com is where you can learn more about it. Otherwise, I'm on Instagram.
For Minnesota Native News, this is Travis Zimmerman.
That's all for this week's episode. Join us next time for more voices and stories that inform, uplift, and shape our communities right here on Minnesota Native News. Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. at UMA.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Federal workers are preparing to auction off logging rights in three national forests in Oregon, despite the government shutdown. That is because the workers were deemed essential after President Trump issued an executive order earlier this year expanding U.S. timber production. Now, Trump also promised to reverse what's called the roadless rule, a ban on logging in almost 60 million acres of national forests. Here's NPR's Kirk Siegler.
While still steady, Oregon's timber industry is a fraction of what it was back in the boom times when a lot more trees were being cut on U.S. Forest Service land. For the last two decades, most of the logs rolling into sawmills like this have been cut off private land. In the old timber town of Cottage Grove, Sean Smith runs the family-owned Starfire Lumber. He says Trump's push to revive logging on public forests is generally well received, but there's an asterisk.
I mean, I think his heart's in the right place, but when you consider the moving parts.
Mills like his are feeling pinched right now, not because they can't get enough logs, but because lumber prices are low. Opening up more public lands to logging could eventually help his margins, but he doubts that'll happen fast. And today's environmental laws mean timber sales take more time to plan or they get tied up in court.
When you consider that you have not only land management agencies, but also fish and wildlife agencies that have to sign off on things.
He says the president can't just sign an executive order and expect the woods around here to get cut down. Congress must pass a long-term forest policy.
I mean, we don't live in a dictatorship, and I, for one, am okay with that. I hope most Americans are.
Smith adds that so many people have left the timber industry since the 1990s, after the notorious timber wars when the endangered spotted owl led to the Forest Service dramatically curtailing timber sales on public land. Some 400 mills across the Northwest closed, a loss of 35,000 jobs. And even if there was a new boom, many mill owners say it'd be hard to find enough people in rural Oregon who want to work in sawmills these days. Alex Owen started at Starfire in 2011 and worked his way up to sawmill supervisor.
For me, I like the high pace, but with all the internet jobs out there today, a lot of the younger kids don't want to do the manual labor that this requires.
President Trump is banking on that changing. His executive order on expanding American timber production says foreign lumber imports have stifled job creation. And further, Trump officials say reversing the 2001 roadless rule will return common sense to forest management. But right now in Oregon, it's widely known that the Forest Service doesn't have enough money to maintain its existing roads and isn't even meeting its timber harvest targets in forests that are already developed.
It's really that backlog that can be capitalized on without entering these pristine areas that have never been cut before.
Huge ferns carpet the understory of a roadless forest that Chandra Lequi is hiking through near the college town of Eugene.
We are walking through a forest of western hemlock and Douglas fir.
Environmentalists like Lequi of Oregon Wild also point to mechanization. So even if more forests are open to logging, there may not be many new jobs.
You know, this area, yeah, at one time, timber was king in western Oregon. Our economy has diversified immensely.
It's likely national environmental groups will sue if the administration fast-tracks repealing the roadless rule without the required environmental analysis. But for Nick Smith with the Portland-based trade group American Forest Resource Council, reversing that rule isn't about a timber boom. It's more about cutting red tape for smaller thinning and fire prevention projects.
We do not mean industrial-style clear cuts, but the real work that needs to be done to restore these forests and make them more resilient to wildfire and climate change.
But right now, everything, wildfires, workforce, or environment pressures, feels like it's being overshadowed by a bigger unknown, the economy. Back at Starfire, owner Sean Smith made the tough decision the other day to stop bringing in any new logs into his yard. Lumber prices remain soft due to sluggish home construction. A mill down the road just closed.
The cynical observation you often hear is the price of everything goes up except lumber.
For now, his mill is running full tilt one shift a day, and Smith is hoping the drop in demand is just a typical seasonal thing going into winter. Kirk Ziegler, NPR News, Cottage Grove, Oregon.
New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham says her state will be the first to offer free child care to everyone. Taylor Velasquez of member station KUNM reports on how it's supposed to work.
Elizabeth Martinez runs a daycare out of her home in Albuquerque.
Let's take turns on it, Dominic. When she's done, then you can play with it.
She has 12 kids in her care, and she's aware of the governor's plans, but not sure about the details. But she's pretty sure this will be a good thing for families in New Mexico. It doesn't take much to make childcare unaffordable.
Being in the business for so long, I do see a lot of struggling parents, and sometimes a dollar or two will kick them off the program.
The state already subsidizes childcare costs for people who make less than four times the federal poverty level. But this new plan would remove income restrictions. Jesse Greenmore, a parent in Santa Fe who works in public health, had to find a new job after budget cuts, but says this announcement convinced her family to stay in New Mexico.
So we decided that we were not going to move to California to be closer to family, to help with childcare. So we have a lot of faith that this is going to go through.
New Mexico expects to spend just under $600 million in the first full year of the program. The state has spent years building early childhood funding. In 2020, it created a $10 billion trust fund using revenue from its booming oil and gas industry. Then in 2022, voters approved drawing more from the land-grant permanent fund. The governor estimates this program will save families up to $12,000 a year. But Republicans here say a universal system isn't the right move. State Party Chair Amy Barella says it's unsustainable as it leads to greater government dependency and thinks overwhelming demand will limit family choice.
Build the services for those that need the services. It is not a universal requirement.
Early Childhood Secretary Elizabeth Gerginski says the planned expansion adds 2,000 childcare slots.
We still have the requirement that families have a reason to need childcare.
The state has not yet said what reasons it will consider. Finding enough childcare workers is a big challenge. Officials estimate they'll need 5,000 more to handle the demand. The state mandates they will be paid at least $18 an hour. Barbara Tetro owns several early childhood centers in Farmington.
I have 125 employees, and to say I am going to increase $6 an hour for 125 employees and pay those payroll taxes, that is a huge burden.
Providers can bill the state for higher wages, but only after employees have already been paid. Families can start filing applications now. The state's goal is for free childcare for all to start on November 1st. For NPR News, I'm Taylor Velasquez in Albuquerque.
This is NPR News.
It's 6:42. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXE on this Indigenous Peoples Day. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Malachi Coons will be playing an hour of Indigenous music, and that is followed at 10 by Three Namblans. It is the Humphrey family choosing some music. Support for KAXE comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. We also thank Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Our weather today, mostly sunny, slight chance for showers early, especially on the Iron Range. Mid-50s, breezy west winds. And tonight, partly cloudy, lows in the low 30s. And for tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the low 50s. You can visit the Screamatorium at Chair in downtown Virginia October 22nd through the 25th and October 29th through November 1st, 6 to 10 each evening. Those in elementary school must be with an adult, and there is a tamer version offered to younger kids on Halloween from 4 to 6. There is an Indigenous Peoples celebration today in Brainerd, 4:30 to 7 at the Gitche Zibi Center for the Arts at the Brainerd High School. See the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Color Guard, a student hand drum group, and the exhibit, Why Treaties Matter. Distribution for the Open Door Coat Rack is at United Methodist Church in Grand Rapids Wednesday, October 22nd from 9 to 6 and Thursday, October 23rd from 9 to 4. Anyone in need of winter clothing is welcome. Coming up just after 7 o'clock, we'll have a special edition of the Up North Report. You can also find the latest at KAXC.org. News from our region. And there is also a podcast you can subscribe to. If there's news in your region we should know about, email us news@kaxe.org. Coming up at 1 o'clock this afternoon, David John, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Right now, we continue with Morning Edition here on People Powered KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from The Economist. In a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, videos, and more at economist.com. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR.
On a Monday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Mae Martinez. Many of the headlines marking the death of actress Diane Keaton this weekend mention Annie Hall. That's the film that earned her an Oscar and made her a distinctively haphazard fashion icon.
Oh, God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
NPR's Bob Mondello says the part of Annie Hall fit her like the black felt hat the character wore so well. But there was always more to Keaton, and audiences sense that.
Diane Keaton was featured in the Broadway musical Hair before she ever appeared on screen. And while the film career that followed spanned six decades, if she had quit Hollywood after just the first, she'd still have been a leading lady for the ages. In just the 1970s, she appeared in two Godfather movies, six films with Woody Allen, including Sleeper, Love and Death, Play It Again, Sam, in a part she had originated on Broadway, and Manhattan. And the year she won a Best Actress Oscar for the comedy Annie Hall, she also left audiences trembling for her repressed schoolteacher caught in a dark spiral of one-night stands in the searing sexual drama Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
I'm alone, not lonely, and depressed, and you're depressing me!
This bouncing back and forth among genres continued throughout her career, winning her Oscar nominations and audience affection in about equal measure. She was nominated for Warren Beatty's Reds, where she played an intense writer hanging out with socialists.
I don't want to be patronized. I'm sorry if you don't believe in mutual independence and free love and respect.
And nominated again for Marvin's Room as a caregiving daughter who ended up needing care herself. Audiences loved the warmth she brought to the knockabout Father of the Bride comedies and the spirit she showed.
Don't tell me what to do.
As a feisty divorcee opposite Bette Midler and Goldie Hawn in First Wives Club.
I go out with you. Don't put me on display.
Pretty good.
You remember.
You don't own me.
Unlike many actresses, Keaton continued to be cast as alluring well into middle age. That was, in fact, the central premise of the romance that earned her her last Oscar nomination, Something's Gotta Give. The co-star close to her age, Jack Nicholson, was dating her on-screen daughter. Such was the custom for leading men. But in a switch from custom, Keaton's character was being wooed by Keanu Reeves.
How old are you?
I'm 36.
So I am like almost 20 years older than you. That's an enormous amount of years to be older than somebody, don't you think?
Don't think it matters at all.
Okay, but in terms of us, I mean, you just want us to be friends, right?
Honestly, no.
So what do you want to be?
I think I'd embarrass you if I told you.
I was embarrassed just getting dressed to see you.
The film worked because Diane Keaton was everything he thought she was. Smart, beautiful, funny, magnetic, just as she was in real life. And in real life, capable of playing pretty much anything. Even a super supportive cartoon Blue Tang mom to the title fish in Pixar's Finding Dory.
You sing the song, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming.
Diane Keaton swam with grace through dozens of character arcs and into audience hearts. I'm Bob Mondello. This is NPR News.
It's 6:49. You're listening to KAXE and the Monday Morning Show. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. We also thank Happy Dancing Turtle, a nonprofit organization dedicated to growing stewards through education, programs, and experiences. More information at happydancingturtle.org. We can expect mostly sunny skies today, slight chance of rain early, mid-50s with breezy west winds. And for tonight, partly cloudy, lows 30 to 33. For tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the low 50s. The Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation hosts the Itasca Area 100 Plus Women Who Care Giving Circle that is this evening at Timber Lake Lodge. Registration starts at 5, program at 5:30. Attendees each contribute $100 and nonprofits are nominated to receive the collective donation. Find more information and register on Facebook. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, a special for this Indigenous Peoples Day from our friends at Interlochen Public Radio. It's a special of Points North. We'll hear about a new hope for Anishinaabemowin, Big Abe LeBlanc, who has been fishing in Lake Superior, and Manoomin, the food that grows on water. That's coming up in our 8 o'clock hour. Right now, there is more ahead from Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. In August 1959, a watchman at a Catholic-run Indian boarding school in British Columbia, Canada, heard a noise, a cry, really, coming from the incinerator. It was a newborn baby left in an ice cream carton. It was author and filmmaker Julian Brave Noisecat's father, Ed. Ed's beginning was unusual, but what followed was not, as he became one of thousands of Native children in Canada and the U.S. who were sent to these schools to strip them of their culture, who became targets of abuse and torture over decades, the scale of which has only recently been acknowledged. Brave Noisecat weaves his father's story into the larger canvas of the Native experience in a new book titled We Survived the Night, and he's with us now to tell us more about it. Julian Brave Noisecat, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the public airwaves.
So let's start with the name of your book. There's a meaning to it.
Yeah, so We Survived the Night, the title of my book, is derived from the traditional way to give the morning greeting in Tsuquet Mokchin. That's my family's language, my indigenous language. We say Chokhwinuk, which doesn't actually translate to good morning. It means you survived the night.
You write about Indian names in your book, and you say names come with responsibilities. So would you tell us about yours?
My dad was found in the trash incinerator at St. Joseph's Mission, the Indian residential school that my family was sent to unlearn our Indian ways. And according to the news article where the night watchman who found him is quoted, his cries for life sounded like the noise of a cat. Hmm. You know, my last name is Noisecat, which is especially kind of mind-blowing to me because our last name Noisecat actually did not originally mean noise cat. That was just the missionaries wrote down the name wrong, essentially. It was originally Noiskit. That was our ancestral Salish name. But then, I don't know, I mean, something about Indians and names, right? The name kind of found its own meaning and story, and it became one of survival.
What a start to life. Your father barely surviving his birth had to have affected his life. And then in turn, it had to have affected your life, which is kind of the core of the book. Tell us what you'd like to tell us about that.
Well, my dad was the first generation of kids on the Canem Lake Indian Reserve that were not taken away to St. Joseph's Mission, the Indian residential school that my grandmother was sent away to. And when you deprive a people, an entire race, of the right to parent their children, eventually you break down the fundamental structures of the family system. You know, my dad was sort of always running from his own demons, his past, and eventually he left both me and my little sister behind. And so the book really is about trying to understand him and our story and what it is to be Native, because my connection to that, you know, my community, was broken when I was a young boy.
You know, you co-directed the Oscar-nominated documentary film called Sugarcane. It follows you and your father's reckoning alongside the story of an investigation that unearthed the remains of more than 200 children at a former Indian residential school in Canada. Why was it important for you to document these difficult conversations?
You know, my father did not know about the circumstances of his own birth and discovery in the trash incinerator until I directed Sugarcane, and until he watched it in the film itself. So I think that part of what I was trying to communicate with that film was why this silence, why this lack of knowledge about what happened to Native people exists in the broader world, in the way that that was in many ways internalized by our own communities and our own people. And then on the flip side of that, you know, as a storyteller, I'm also thinking very purposefully about what traditions were nearly wiped out by those schools, and that I, as a Native storyteller, have a responsibility to bring back to life on the page.
You know, we're talking about this as if it's kind of a linear narrative, but that isn't how the book unfolds. It's actually remarkably rich and multi-layered. You kind of lace it with Native mythology, if I can use that term, about the coyote in particular. Could you read a little bit, please?
Yeah. You know, my people don't tell the coyote stories really anymore. And so, you know, as I was working on the book, I was also reading these old coyote stories that were gathered up in ethnographic texts 100 plus years ago. And I just started to notice that there were so many parallels between our trickster ancestor, this guy called Coyote, who was sent to the earth by the creator to set things in order, and who was a trickster. So he did a lot of good, but he also messed a lot of stuff up. And, you know, my own father, with whom I have a loving but, you know, complex backstory. So here, I guess I'll read a story about how our people narrated the arrival of the first white man in our territory as the return of the trickster coyote. This is from a chapter called The Drifters. The most common account held that coyote would reappear in the end times. When things came full circle, the trickster who molded the world into its indigenous state would be there just to do whatever trickster blank needed to be done. Make something like a sun, or break something like the witch's fishing weir, or steal something like goose eggs or a wife, or invent essential ergonomic functions like the elbow, or live a life full of damn good stories. Because how the world ends is just as important as how it begins.
That's wonderful. You know, before I let you go, I don't want to erase your mom.
Yeah.
She has her own story.
She does.
Your mom is not a Native person.
Nope.
And the book is dedicated to her.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how you decided to make sure she had presence in the story.
You know, the truth is that she raised me, so she was always going to have presence. And you know, even though she's non-Native, she's an Irish Jewish New Yorker. And if you hear her talk, you'll hear it. You know, she did things like, after my father and her split, she would still take me to visit his family so that I could understand my culture and who I was. She even learned how to bead so that I could have my own powwow regalia to travel and dance.
Wow. So do you have a hope for this book, what it will do?
When we include Native people in the story, I think that we understand this place a bit differently. My people have always considered the coyote stories nonfiction, and I think that it's long past time that the social sciences actually take these ideas and these stories seriously, because there's a reason we told them for thousands and thousands of years. And you can't tell me right now that this is not a world that is still spun around by tricksters and their tricks.
Julian Brave Noisecat is the author of We Survived the Night. Julian Brave Noisecat, thank you so much for talking with us.
Cook's Jam, Michelle. Really love the conversation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
It's a minute before 7 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. There's lots of local content there for you to check out, stories to listen to and to read. And you can become a member by clicking on that donate button. Again, it's KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll have more ahead from Morning Edition from National Public Radio. In just a few moments, the Up North Report, local news from our region. In our 8 o'clock hour, we have a special edition of Points North, a podcast from our friends at Interlochen Public Radio in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Stories for Indigenous Peoples Day.